Good evening and welcome to the Jewish Center's May and Samuel Rudin Lecture. As many of you know, Mr. Jack Rudin grew up in the Jewish Center, and together with Susan sponsors this lecture series in memory of his parents, who were longtime members and leaders. The goal is to provide the New York community with the opportunity to hear from outstanding scholars, statesmen, and public figures on issues of critical importance to contemporary society. Tonight, we are celebrating the 10th anniversary of the Rudin Lecture Series. Since it began, the series has become a major event, as we've hosted mayors and senators, ambassadors and authors, university presidents and chancellors, the former Secretary of State, former U.S. Attorney General, the Chief Rabbi of the United Kingdom, a Nobel laureate, and tonight, the Green Prince, one of the most valuable spies in the history of the State of Israel. Now, it's not often that we have spies with us here at the Jewish Center, at least not to my knowledge. So if there's anything you prefer not to be known to the international intelligence gathering agencies, you might want to think twice before you text anything during tonight's program. The Jewish Center is deeply grateful to Jack and Susan for their visionary leadership and their boundless generosity. Though Jack and Susan are not able to be here tonight, we thank them from afar. For those of you who are guests, or if you only join us occasionally here at the Jewish Center, I invite you to join us often. Part of our ongoing mission is to be a source of wisdom and inspiration for our entire community. This weekend, for instance, we're delighted to welcome our new community scholar, Erica Brown. There's still time to register for our Friday night dinner together with her. And if today's weather has you thinking about the spring, you can mark your calendar for Wednesday evening, May 6th, which is the date of our next Rudin Lecture. We'll have the pleasure of hosting Daniel Libeskind, the world-renowned architect and master planner of the Freedom Tower. You know, it's difficult to escape the many layers of connection between our speaker this evening and the hero of our Parsha this week. Like the Green Prince, the biblical Yosef also began his career with the connection that he made while serving time in a prison in the Middle East. Yosef, too, held prominent positions that were unknown to his father and to his family. And thanks to his smarts and courage, Yosef also saved countless lives. But to me, the most striking parallel between Mossad Hassan Yosef and his biblical namesake is that each was faced with a decision, a choice between conforming to the pressures of the local environment or maintaining a higher ethic and answering to a higher calling. Joseph could have just as easily become an Egyptian, an identity that would have felt very comfortable and very much at home. And yet instead, he chose a path that ultimately placed him on the right side of history and earned him a place among our nation's heroes. Mossad Hassan Yosef also faced a choice. It would have been all too natural for him to assume a leadership role in Hamas. Instead, at great personal risk, he chose a path that had the effect of saving hundreds, if not thousands, of lives, thanks directly to his work with the Shin Bet over the career spanning 10 years. We are able to declare today that the enemies of the Jewish people are weaker and the State of Israel is stronger because of Mossad. I would normally share a brief biographical sketch of our speaker, but by this point, all of us have come to know the story of the Green Prince. And Mossad, every person in this room tonight joins the community of Jews all over the world in thanking you for all that you have done for the Jewish people and for the State of Israel. Please join me now in welcoming our May and Samuel Rudin scholar, Mossad Hassan Yosef.
Wow. I usually get the standing ovation afterwards. This is the first time I'm getting it beforehand. Thank you for the warm welcoming. And thank you, Rabbi, for the kindness. I don't deserve all these descriptions and honors, to be honest with you. First of all, I didn't know what I'm doing here. What's the son of Hamas leader doing in a synagogue? Sometimes I ask myself a question, what is it? Maybe I was a bad Jew in my previous life. Then I had to be reincarnated in this life cycle to fix my karma. It's a possibility. There is a huge connection between me and the Jewish nation. Truly. I just came back from Israel. People would follow me on the buses, on the airplane, trains, soldiers, police officers. It's overwhelming. I cannot live in Israel. I cannot walk down the streets. I cannot go to the beach. It's impossible. Too much love. And I really, really appreciate it. So thank you so much for your welcoming, and thank you so much for being here. My name is Mus'ab, and my father is Sheikh Hassan Youssef. He is one of the founders of Hamas movement, one of the founders of the Muslim Brotherhood. He named me Mus'ab before I was born. Why Mus'ab? My mother used to tell me the story when I was very young, that unlike most Muhammad's followers, Muhammad the Prophet of Islam, Mus'ab was coming from a royal family, a rich family. He had a very comfortable life. And he had to get out of his comfort zones and follow the path of Muhammad. Unlike most of Muhammad's followers were slaves, they did not have anything to lose. Actually, when they followed Muhammad, they had expectations. But Mus'ab left everything behind. And he became the first Islamic ambassador. My mother used to tell me his response to his mother when she striked. She told him, I will not eat till I die, unless you come back to the religion of your fathers. And Mus'ab told her, if you had seven souls and you lose one after another, I'm not going to leave the message of Muhammad and the path of Islam. Basically, my mother was telling me, this is our expectations from you. Actually, she used to tell me that you were born in a mosque. At a very young age, I go to the mosque. I was only 7 years old. And I woke up one morning, my father was already going to the mosque for the morning prayer. That was probably 4:30 a.m. And I had to go by the graveyard, by the cemetery, in order to get to the mosque. It was very dark, no light, it was very scary. And my mother asked me, just please stay, you go tomorrow. I told her, no way, I have to go to the mosque. And I found my way to the mosque. I remember some angry homeless dogs attacking me. It was very scary. And I was very young still. And this is how much I loved Islam. This is how much I wanted to be a good Muslim from the beginning. It's not because the Islamic duties were very difficult and at some point I had to leave. That was not the reason. From a very young age, I dedicated my life. I suffered side by side with my family, with my mother, for the sake of Islam and for the sake of Hamas. My My father moved us to this cemetery in 1986, and that was 1 year before the first Palestinian Intifada. And the cemetery was a very scary place. I was afraid to go in. One day, I saw a group of people taking a corpse to bury him. And I thought, this is my opportunity to go in for the first time. With a group of people, it's much safer. I remember I was only 9 or 10 years old. They put the man down. They uncover his face. For the first time, I see a dead man. They face him towards Mecca. This is an Islamic tradition. Then they start burying him. The Imam starts to tell a story, to tell us what happens after everybody leaves. He said, after his family and his friends leave, two angels, Munkar and Nakir, will come to the grave and bring his soul back to his body. And they will ask him questions. Who is your prophet? Who is your God? And if he doesn't know the answers, they will smash him with a hammer that will take him 70 years down in earth. There will be a scorpion the size of a camel. There will be a snake with 199 heads. And I was like, wait a second. I never felt good about this cemetery. And I believed what he said. I went home thinking about this story. And I wanted to know. I wanted to go back and hear the torture. Hear the interrogation. But none of my friends would go with me. I was very afraid, but I was very curious. Somehow I made my way back to the cemetery. I got closer to the grave. I was very scared. I did not hear anything. I got closer and closer. Eventually, I found myself putting my ear on the soil, trying to hear something. And I did not hear anything. Then I started hanging out in the cemetery. It became somehow my new playground. I went back home, and I told my mother. The Imam said 1, 2, 3, 4. And I went back, and it was not true. She started yelling at me. Said, why don't you act like all other children? Why do you have to go back? Because I put lots of effort in that, and it was a very challenging mission. I started crying. I was very disappointed of her reaction. Then when she saw me crying, she told me, son, only animals would hear the interrogation and the torture of the grave. Humans don't get the chance to hear it. And I believed her. I mentioned the story for you to understand how I was behaving since I was very young. I like to do things, to do my own experiment, to know the truth firsthand. Not from a third party, not from indirect. Directly, and this is how it has been. I always find my way back to the grave. Anyway, we go back to the story. My father moved us to the Ramallah area, and we did not see most of him. He was very busy establishing Hamas. In 1987, the Israeli soldiers came to arrest him. I didn't know why. I asked, where are you taking him? They said, don't worry, we're taking him only for 5 minutes. I went outside, I waited for 5 minutes. For more than that, my father did not come back. And from that point, I hated Israel. I hated the Israeli soldiers who put Israeli uniform. That was a personal reason to hate the state of Israel. The second reason was ideological reason. The God of Islam does not like the Jews. And this is not a secret. Muhammad, the Prophet of Islam, cleansed the Jews of the Arab Peninsula. He brought them to the center of Medina and slaughtered them as he slaughtered the sheep. For no reason. And the main reason for the Islamic fight against the Jews and against the state of Israel because of their inspiration of the behavior of Muhammad. Growing up in the Palestinian territories, I had also political and national reasons. So now we're talking about personal reasons, ideological, political and national ones. My reality and my perceptual ability was completely distorted. I couldn't see a higher truth. At the age of 17, I purchased guns and I had a plan to take revenge from the enemies of Allah, of the nation, of our family. Thankfully, I was arrested by the Israeli intelligence. I mean, thankfully. Interrogation was not nice at all. I was beaten by angry Israeli soldiers who basically knew that I was the son of a top Hamas leader. It was against the laws of the state of Israel. But they were very frustrated. It was during a wave of suicide bombing attacks. And they thought, this is how they punish a terrorist or terrorism, by beating me almost all the way from Beit El to West Jerusalem. In the interrogation center, it was very dark. It was very loud music. I was not allowed to sleep for many nights continuously. And it was very rough. I spent there for about 3 months. I literally forgot how I looked like. One day, a representative of the Israeli intelligence came and asked me if I was willing to work for the state of Israel. In my reality, I was thinking to myself, is this guy out of his mind? You know, after everything you did to our family, after everything you did to me, like, look at you here, what you're doing in this interrogation center. And now you're asking me to work for you? Motivated by revenge, I said yes. I'll work for you guys. I thought, if I agree to work for the state of Israel, they will release me from prison. And I will get a chance to penetrate the agency, manipulate them, and attack them from within. Don't be scared. I was very angry, very young, motivated by hatred and revenge. I could not see a higher truth or a different reality. Now when I agreed, I thought they would tell me just go home. But they came back with a different proposal. They said, we have to send you to prison because if we release you now, everybody will get suspicious of you and they will kill you. Go spend some time with the Hamas people in prison, get to know to them, and after you're released, we will sit down, we will talk. I thought to myself, what is the mission? No mission, no device, no James Bond, nothing. So I was sent to prison. We had about 2,000 Hamas members. In prison, Hamas was like a mini-government. They had a security wing, and the security wing was looking for collaborators with Israel. Anyone who was suspicious of collaborating with the state of Israel, they were tortured. Many of them were killed. People were screaming in lots of pain. And for Hamas, in order to prevent the Israeli administration of knowing what was going on, they used to put the soap bar in the mouth of the prisoner, afterwards put needles under their fingernails, and burn their bodies. Some of those prisoners went under this brutal torture for months, and some of them actually for more than a year. And I was witnessing their screaming and their pain on a daily basis. Now, when my father used to tell me at the dinner table, in case he gets killed, to take care of my mother, of my siblings, to be strong, that used to make me cry. For what? For the sake of Hamas? Hamas' goal was to destroy the state of Israel and build an Islamic state on the rubble of the state of Israel. And the goal was to bring Palestinian people justice, to emancipate them, and bring them liberation. And here we are in prison. They're torturing our people and they're killing them. It did not make sense to me. I grew up in a family thinking like a leader, not like a soldier. And here I am face to face for the first time with the real nature of Hamas organization. I spent in prison 16 months witnessing their brutality. And I thought to myself, I don't want to be a part of this anymore. But on the other hand, I already gave my word to the Israeli intelligence. But now why would I serve Israel or serve Hamas? I just wanted to go, take care of my school, move on in my life. I did not want to be part of any of this. After I was released from prison, I received a phone call. It was from the Israeli intelligence. They said, welcome back. I said, thank you. And thank you for sending me for a very short time in prison. And thank you for telling me that Hamas was torturing and killing people in prison for the suspicion of collaborating with Israel. They said, listen, we cannot talk about anything right now on the phone. Why don't you come for a meeting? Then we will discuss this. I thought to myself, it would be respectful to go and just finish this peacefully. I did not have intention to harm them anymore, and I did not have intention to work for them either. The day of the meeting, they asked me, come to this gas station. I go to the gas station. Make a phone call. I made a phone call. And go to another gas station. From the gas station, go to the street, to that corner, for hours and hours. Finally, this car stops. Two of the security guards just push me into the car, cover me, and start driving. You can't drive the whole state of Israel, as most of us know, in a few hours. For this trip, it took more than that. I found myself in a basement somewhere in Israel, and here I am face to face with the Israeli intelligence officer, the guy who recruited me. In that meeting, lots of things went on, but the most important thing that I learned in that meeting, that none of those people who were tortured in prison actually had a relationship with the Israeli intelligence, not even one person. Hamas used to bring a prisoner, put him under lots of physical and mental pressure. They had no choice, no option, but to mention hundreds of names as their network. This is not how intelligence works. This is not how Israel worked. For 10 years I worked for the Israeli intelligence. They never connected me with other agents in the field. And that was very shocking. First of all, I did not like Hamas' brutality against collaborators. Now to know that this brutality was against innocent people that was even much worse. I start to ask myself, what other things I don't know about ourselves, now I'm learning from my father's worst enemies, the people that I wanted to destroy and kill at some point. Now I became motivated by curiosity. I wanted to know more. So I agreed for the second meeting, and the third meeting, and the fourth. And for about 3 years, I spent most of the time meeting with Israeli intelligence to learn about our own society, to see our reality through their lens. It was a very awkward relationship. They did not trust me, I did not trust them. You won't believe how they used to take me from a place to a place. For example, I know probably they will not appreciate this, but I'll expose one of the secrets. They used to put me in a vehicle that looks like a vehicle from the outside. It was armored on the inside, not the outside. In case I had explosives on me, or a bomb or something, and blow myself up, I will only kill myself. And the vehicle will become two parts, will detach. So the guards will be safe, unharmed. So imagine yourself going to a meeting in this type of vehicle. What are you going to think? What's going to come to your mind? Those people did not trust me at all for 3 years. And I did not trust them either. But somehow, gradually, I start to see a different reality. I was very honest with them from day one that my intention was to penetrate the agency, to harm them from within, because I was very angry and very frustrated. They took that in consideration, but that stained my file till the last moment I was working for the agency. They never gave me a break. 3 years awkward and weird relationship. But I start to see humanity in them. They start to see humanity in me. They start to learn more about Hamas organization and understand the environment that shaped Hamas mentality. And I was very happy actually to share. I wanted somehow to make them understand that not everybody was born this way. For example, my father is a top Hamas leader. I did not see in him like other Hamas leaders. This does not mean that he's doing the right thing. Unfortunately, whether if they were doves or hooks, if they were moderate or fanatics, all of them lived in a falsehood of consciousness, motivated by shame, guilt, fear, revenge, anger. They never come to the truth of tolerance, unconditional love, and forgiveness. With that said, I thought to myself, what if those Israeli hunters that I'm working with right now grew up in Ramallah? What if you guys grew up in a refugee camp? Where would you be today? Would you be sitting in a synagogue? Our environment shapes us in a certain way. Some of us submit and obey. The others choose to write their own scripts and choose to have direct perception of reality and of life. This means that they have to get out of their comfort zone. The sheep follow the shepherd. The sheep believes that the shepherd is their best friend, because the shepherd provides water and food. But eventually, the shepherd takes them to the slaughterhouse. He is their worst enemy. And when you live in an environment where you have food, water, comfort, security, friends, family, culture, language. Nobody wants to get out of that or question it. But here I am, I'm seeing a different truth. We blamed all our problems on the state of Israel, even our social problems. A father who cut the throat of his daughter, excuse me for the description, but this is what it is, because she dated somebody. It's a very dark culture. How can you blame this and that and everything on the state of Israel? It became very easy for us to escape our reality, and instead of facing it with courage, to blame it on what's so-called occupation, or the Jews, or Israel, or the United States. And I did not like this. Especially during the 3 years at the beginning, when I was with Israeli intelligence, they did not give me a gun and tell me, go kill all Palestinians. They didn't say, go and destroy the infrastructure of the people. They actually asked me to be a good citizen, to be a good Palestinian, to be respectful to the people and to my parents. And I found that surprising, because the wisdom on the Palestinian street, wisdom, is that Israel is trying day and night to destroy our people, to destroy our education, our value system, our belief system, to make a person rape his mother, for example, and film that on a camera and bring it to the agency so they can blackmail his mother. This is what they used to tell us in prison. And here we are. It's a completely different reality. And I wanted to get out of all my comfort zone, to cross all my barriers for the sake of truth. As I went back to the grave when I was 10 years old, I choose to go back to the grave whenever I have to listen and to make sure if there is torture or there is no torture. Whether it was coming from a holy man or coming from someone from the streets. Most people rely on their truths from the news, from the mosque, from other sources. And their perceptual ability is distorted. As Socrates described the human condition in his allegory of the cave, people looking at shadows. The shadows are basically their shadows and the objects behind them because of the fire or the light. They're looking at the wall and they're seeing shadows. They think that this is the truth. They're looking at shadows of images and they believe that this is real. Why? Because we are limited to our senses and to our minds. And the mind is very deceptive. And our senses deceive us most of the time. Our biggest problem that we don't see things for what they are. And this is what I learned from our work with Israeli intelligence. For many years we created a reality for somebody. We made them believe that this is life. And they believed in it. But it was only a game. Like for example, my father during the second Palestinian Intifada was in a safe house. He thought that he was hiding from Israel or the Israeli intelligence. While only the Israeli intelligence knew about this location. One day the IDF came to the area and the Shin Bet told them, you go look for Hassan Youssef. They did not want anything to be suspicious. If they don't tell the IDF, go look for Hassan Youssef, the IDF officers or generals start questioning why the Shin Bet is not asking for Hassan Youssef. Even though the Shin Bet knew about my father's location all the time. So now, here's the idea. Taking his picture, his name, knocking from door to door. asking for his name. When they came to the neighborhood where he was hiding, he heard them asking the neighbors for his name. And they searched every house. But because the Shin Bet told the IDF, this specific house, we have something going on there, just don't go inside. So he could not believe it. For days, he's afraid. Now they're going to knock on the door, they're going to shoot me in the head. Nothing happened. The troops left, and when I came to visit him, he said, Mus'ab, you wouldn't believe what happened. I said, what happened? He said, they came. I heard them asking everywhere my name. I heard my name many times. And said, but praise Allah, they were blinded, they did not see this place. I thought to myself, well, in this case, your Allah is the Israeli intelligence. So this gives you an idea, you know, how you create a reality for somebody, and they would believe in it. The second Palestinian Intifada started. A couple of months before the second Palestinian Intifada, I had an encounter with Christ consciousness. I'm not talking about the Jesus, you know, that people preach here in the West and the East. I'm talking about Christ consciousness. You know, it's like the end of the day, Jesus was Jewish. Which is something I'm very proud of. You know? Christ consciousness. Love thy enemy. And I was in a state of confusion. I didn't know who my enemy was anymore. And here I am, having a new challenge. And I thought that level of consciousness was higher than Allah's consciousness. That encouraged and still encouraging Muslims to take revenge and to kill and to destroy rather than forgive and tolerate and love. So I took that challenge. And I thought to myself, here I am, I've been in a relationship with my worst enemies. I wanted to destroy them at some point. I saw humanity in them. I don't see that they have wrong intentions towards our people. All they're doing is to protect their people and do the right thing against brutal suicide bombing attacks. And I thought to myself, can I love them unconditionally? And I took the challenge, and it was a new beginning. They did not even notice it. I did not tell them. But deep within, that was my new motive. It started with revenge, curiosity, and here I am, unconditional love. And I wanted to test this theory of love thy enemy, see how it works in this very difficult situation. The second Palestinian Intifada started, and I found myself in the heart of the decision-making behind all the suicide bombing attacks, demonstrations, Yasser Arafat meetings, other top leaders of the Intifada, Marwan Barghouti, my father. Actually, every word was said in any meeting for the top leaders of the second Palestinian Intifada was written and was passed on me, and I passed it on the Israeli intelligence. Basically, we knew everything that was going on. For me, I had two choices. To stick my head in the sand and say, I know nothing, or do something about the violence. Suicide bombing attacks did not differentiate between Arab or Jewish or Israeli or Muslim. All people were targeted. And for me, I asked myself, how can you go wrong by saving a human life? It's not for the sake of the state of Israel or the Israeli intelligence only. It's for the sake of humanity. And I start to have this higher consciousness. I start to believe in what I'm doing. And I was capable of doing things. Of course, I don't get credits alone because that was part of effort from everybody. IDF, police, Shin Bet. It was a teamwork. And it's unfair for me to stand here today safe in the United States and take credits for things that people did and they're still doing under very difficult circumstances. One of the days, I had two strangers come into our house. And I asked them, how can I help you? They said, we're looking for Sheikh Hassan Yusuf. I said, this is my father and he's not here. They said, but we need him, it's urgent. I said, I can help him. You won't be able to get a hold of him. He's in a safe house and he does not have phones. It's impossible. And that was part of our strategy, to isolate him. So all the connections would come to me first. And we know what was going on. Basically, those people are telling me, we are five suicide bombers came from Jordan. And we are about to go commit suicide in Jerusalem. It was a big Jewish event. Rabbi Ovadia Yusuf was a target there. And they were planning to kill many people. And I was, this is crazy. First of all, how many times we put our hands on a suicide bomber before they reach their target? Just for your information. And this time we have five of them coming to us. Now I cannot tell them, hey guys, wait a second, let me call my Israeli handler and see what can I do. You know, you have to act immediately. And those suicide bombers, if they're gone, you only hear about them in the news. So I told them, listen, what is this car? They said, this is our car and we have all our gear in it. I got closer to the car. The car was full of explosive belts, guns, rifles. I told them, guys, you cannot take this. It's very suspicious. I have to keep the car in a safe place. Here is money and here's a phone number and address. You go to this location and you wait for me. I took the car and I had no other place to hide it but in our own garage. And I did not have one reason to convince my mother to leave the house with my siblings. If anything went wrong, my entire family would be killed. But I had to take that risk. That was not a joke. You know, having five suicide bombers with their gear about to go blow themselves up and they just need some help for a few hours. I called the Israeli intelligence and in 30 minutes the Israeli Prime Minister decided to drop a bomb on their apartment where I put them in a safe house. I refused because I did not want to be part of killing even a terrorist. It was very important for me to keep this compass, to keep my intention pure. I had many personal problems with the Hamas people. By the way, the Hamas security wing in prison who were torturing the people in prison were the same exact leaders of the military wing outside. Like someone like Ibrahim Hamid, he is responsible for the death and the killing of hundreds of Israelis. He's in Israeli prison right now. He was the top Hamas security wing in prison, top leader, and outside he was the top military wing leader. So basically, I could have said, you know, kill them. But for me, I wanted to keep this level of morality, and I refused. They agreed to arrest them. On their way, in the vehicle, they mentioned my name. And that was the biggest concern of the Israeli intelligence. They told me from the beginning, if we kill them, they will not get a chance to mention your name. If we arrest them, they will mention your name during the interrogation, and you will have to go to prison. And I said, I'll take the risk. Now, Israel does not tolerate anybody who helped a suicide bomber. How could we explain this to the Palestinian public, that I helped suicide bombers, give them shelter and money, and now I am free? So we had to play again to create another reality, but this time on much higher scale, much bigger than the reality we created for my father. In the book, we call it the game, for the people who read the book, Son of Hamas. First of all, the Israeli intelligence told the IDF, look, we have information that the son of Hassan Yusuf has a relationship with suicide bombers and the Hamas military wing. He's highly dangerous, he's armed, and we have information that he's coming to visit his mother tonight. Get ready, we're going in. Everybody start to get ready. First of all, they sent the special forces undercover. They were within 2 minutes from our house. And that was the moment when I got a phone call to make it like I'm escaping. And I escaped the location. Special forces came, then the IDF, then the tanks, then the choppers, and they start calling for my name. My mother said, he's not in the house. They evacuated her, they evacuated my brothers and sisters, made sure nobody in the house, and when I did not surrender, they start shooting at the house. Eventually they launched a missile, and half of the house was on fire. In my room, 150 bullets. This is how serious they were to kill me. And the honest truth, they were just deceived. They didn't know that was arranged. Basically, we wanted Al Jazeera to come down and film this whole scene. Once they put it on Al Jazeera, everybody in the city of Ramallah or in the West Bank will believe that I am a terrorist, that Israel did not tolerate my relationship with suicide bombers, and here I am wanted, and Israel is very serious about killing me. Which gave me the opportunity to act like a wanted person, and I ended up hanging out with all Hamas wanted people, and we knew about their locations, and we continued our game for about a year. Then when I got exhausted of the game, I told them, guys, please take me to prison. I'm done. And I was arrested for 6 months undercover, hanging out with the bad guys. Some of you might think, you know, when we achieved something like this, when we arrested a suicide bomber, that we were opening a bottle of champagne and celebrating, but that was not the reality. I spent about 27 months in Israeli prisons. Most of it was for cover. And I was happy with whatever we were doing, because we were doing important things. Not only for the Israeli people, by the way, also for the Palestinian people. For humanity. Again, there is no way to go wrong by saving a human life. After many years, I came to realize that we were fighting a ghost. We were fighting an ideology. Hamas is one manifestation of the Islamic ideology. And I came to realize that the Islamic religion is the main enemy of the Arab culture, Arab community. I connected all the social problems, and always I found the source coming from that theory. Because in Islam there is no separation between politics and religion. And in the case of a movement like Hamas, that is not a political movement, it's an ideological religious movement, which their goal to control and conquer the globe, to build an Islamic state. And there is no way to satisfy their ambition. If the state of Israel tomorrow give Hamas the 1967 borders, for example, Hamas will still not recognize the right of Israel to exist. They are determined on destroying the state of Israel. And they're motivated by their ideology. And I came to realize that the only way to fight Hamas, besides using the gun when we have to, is to fight their ideology. The Islamic ideology. And this is when I decided to move to the United States of America. I came here, I observed the situation from outside for about a year, and I decided to write the book, Son of Hamas, to expose the real nature of Hamas, their motives, and the Islamic ideology in general. And since that moment, I've been going to different places, fighting against radicalism, fighting against Islam itself. I personally don't differentiate between political Islam or Islam. I think Islam itself is a problem. And now when we look at the Islamic State, Boko Haram, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, Hezbollah, Al-Qaeda, Taliban, Shabab in Somalia, and we can continue the list, it's a very long list. This cannot be just an accident. There has to be something. It's not only misinterpretation of the religion. People make it sound like Islam is a victim of Islamists. But it's not. And I have responsibility towards the people there. On one hand, we need to unify our effort. I'm not asking you because I know it's very sensitive for you as a Jewish community. And basically, you know, I know probably you're not even comfortable for me to talk about things like this in a synagogue. But this is very important to understand. And we need to create awareness that this enemy is not only against Israel. Islamists are not only fighting against Israel, and Israel is not only fighting to protect itself. Israel is fighting on behalf of humanity to protect the evolvement of the human consciousness and the higher interests of humanity. This is what's happening. As a democratic country that has room for all type of people, this is where I stand. I just came back from Israel, and the more I learn about the Israeli people, the Jewish nation in general, which is, you know, I'm still learning about the history. I was recently in Hungary after I went to Israel on my way back to the United States. And I've been to the oldest, biggest synagogue in Europe, Budapest. And it was just fascinating to walk in and to learn about the values, to learn about the history, to learn about the suffering. How many millions died on the hands of the Nazis? And I look at the Jewish nation holding the ground, giving humanity unconditionally, values, science, name it, everything. And this amazing nation did not lose itself in the process. I said many times to our people that Israel in the region is not the problem, it's a solution. And I really mean it. Because if Palestinian people look at the Israel and the Jewish nation and understand how this nation overcome an event like the Holocaust, and was able to forgive, was able to move on. Look at the relationship today between Germany and Israel, Germany and the Jewish people. It explains how this higher level of consciousness that calibrates in truth, and I believe in the Jewish values. I actually take them personally very seriously. And I believe that this is the light that helped humanity evolve. I definitely stand by the Jewish nation. Not only because you're warm welcoming. Not because one day I served with Israeli intelligence. Because it's very important in times like this to stay strong. And I just want you to know that whatever I did in the past is nothing. Because you taught me how to do good, how to be a better person, and how to help the evolvement of humanity. Thank you so much for being here, and thank you so much for being who you are, and we put our trust in the divine. Thank you so much.
me ask everyone to please remain in their seats for just a moment. Musab has very graciously agreed to meet with us downstairs. We're going to give Musab a moment to head out of the sanctuary. And when he does, I'm going to invite everyone to follow. We'll have some refreshments downstairs. And I'll just ask that you please be patient if you'd like to approach Musab with a question. Once again, we thank him for this extraordinary evening.